I'm Christopher Lydon with Professor Noam Chomsky in his MIT office, the closest thing we have to Socrates in the American public square, a scathing questioner of virtually every common premise about who we are as Americans and what we're up to in the world. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. I'm thinking of this one as a sort of Chomsky report on our midterm condition in October 2010. Noam Chomsky, you're a discontented figure in a discontented country. Why aren't you out there leading the Tea Party, or at least helping them understand what they think they're angry about?
Well, partly because they're not asking me. I'd be glad to talk to them. Certainly, I hope your introduction isn't intended as a prediction. Remember what happened to Socrates.
You'll duck the hemlock somehow.
Yeah.
Do you have a notion of what stirs them? Is there any shared citizen dismay here? I think there must be.
Oh, there is, definitely. First of all, there have been some pretty close studies of the Tea Party and its attitudes, so we don't have to just speculate. But first of all, we have to at least break apart two different groups. One are the Tea Party activists, the ones who show up at the small conferences, a couple hundred people and so on, and the Tea Party sympathizers, the people who say, well, this resonates with me somehow. That latter group is huge. It could be half the population. And the two groups are quite different. The larger group is approving of this partially on the basis of real grievances, authentic, real grievances, which would be organized by the left if there was an active functioning left, as it was, say, in the 1930s or the 1960s or farther back in our history. But now it isn't happening. The grievances are very, very understandable. For over 30 years, real wages have pretty much stagnated for a majority of the population. Working hours have gone up. Benefits, which were never very good, have deteriorated. Insecurity has increased. Actually, that was the purpose of a lot of the programs. Alan Greenspan was very frank about it when he was, during the Clinton years, when he was testifying to Congress on his great success as running this wonderful economy. He said one of the major achievements is to have created, in his words, greater worker insecurity. And that's supposed to be good, because if you have worker insecurity, working people don't ask for wages, rights, benefits, and so on. You have what economists call a more flexible labor force, meaning you can control them better. They don't cut into profits or managerial prerogatives. People are getting by, but by having two members of the family, two adults working, which is difficult, harder in the United States than elsewhere, because we have a weak social support system, comparatively speaking. It means children are alone. They're under tremendous pressure, all kinds of pressure, including the pressure to consume massively. So there's a huge propaganda system here. It exists elsewhere, but much greater here, to try to maximize essentially pointless consumption. And its children are subjected to it virtually from infancy. You look at children's television programs, they're barraged with it. The parents can put food on the table if they both work, and if they go into debt, and if they rely on asset inflation. And it was very fragile, and there was plenty of insecurity. So they had a lot to complain about. I mean, they could see that there is wealth being generated, and not as much as in the 50s and the 60s, but still substantial, going into very few pockets. So we by now have maybe the highest inequality in American history, certainly since the 20s.
This sounds so much like Robert Reich's critique, and I take your point. If we had a labor-left movement, there would be lots of organizing. But I'm also thinking, if we had the anti-imperialist league of, say, 1900 or 1910, there would be a lot of lot of work for them to do and a lot of reception, I think, for those ideas. The puzzle is that we don't, and I don't understand why not.
Well, first of all, the Anti-Imperialist League was important, but it was pretty small. It was a small group of...
Big-time people, including Andrew Carnegie and Mark Twain and...
Yeah, big-time people, but very small, and pretty much suppressed. Take Mark Twain, who was one of the leading figures, and, you know, major figure in American life and literature. His anti-imperialist essays were pretty much suppressed.
Some of the lines are memorable, though, that the talons of the great American eagle don't belong on any other soil, things like that.
Yeah.
And passionate.
Passionate, important. William James, others in a small group, which had some effect, but wasn't a mass movement. In fact, my feeling is we have much more anti-imperialist sentiment today. In fact, quite a lot more in the public. You know, it's not what it should be, in my opinion, but it's more substantial than in the 60s. Take a look at the 60s, which people tend to forget. I mean, the United States invaded South Vietnam in 1962. That's John F. Kennedy. That's when he sent the U.S. Air Force to start bombing South Vietnam. He authorized napalm. He authorized chemical warfare to destroy crops and livestock and forest cover, which was being used by the resistance forces. He began the programs which pretty soon drove millions of people into what amounted to concentration camps. They had euphemisms for them, the purpose being to protect them from the guerrillas, who he knew and his advisors knew they were supporting. If anybody else did that, if any other country did that, we'd call it aggression. There was literally virtually no protest, almost nothing. You know, the war was far beyond anything that's happened in Iraq and Afghanistan. Well, finally, a year or two later, there was a substantial popular movement, but it was very slow in coming. If you compare it to Iraq and Afghanistan, they have never reached the level of Vietnam at the time when there was still no protest. And I think part of the reason is because opposition is so much greater that the government was unable to do what Kennedy and Johnson could do without any disruption. Nothing like the same, no saturation bombing by B-52s, no chemical warfare, you know, and so on. Things that were done by Kennedy and early Johnson virtually without protest that they can't even think of doing now. Well, that's because the anti-imperialist popular league has in fact grown. What's happened more generally is that just general consciousness has changed on all sorts of issues. So lots of things that were considered perfectly legitimate in the early 1960s are almost out of the question now. Women's rights, you know, environmental concerns, gay rights, civil rights for blacks. A lot of things have changed in the country. It's gotten a lot more civilized. And one part of that is anti-imperialism. You can take a look at polls now. The majority for some time has been in favor of withdrawal from Afghanistan. That didn't happen in the case of Vietnam until it was way beyond the level of any fighting now. So it's important, it's real. The Anti-Imperialist League was an important pocket of American intellectual history. It did not succeed in impeding the war effort. The U.S. in the Philippines probably killed a couple hundred thousand people. It was a vicious, brutal war with all kinds of atrocities. And after the war, after the resistance was more or less suppressed, the U.S. imposed a very sophisticated system of population control, and it lasted. It's lasted until today. You take a look at that region, Southeast and East Asia, there's one country that hasn't taken part in the very substantial, often spectacular growth of the last few generations, the Philippines. It's still a basket case.
Mm. Come back to the Tea Party for a moment. I remarked to Jill Lepore the other day that Henry David Thoreau might be out leading the Tea Party were he around. I mean, he opposed the war with Mexico, stopped paying taxes, went to jail on the issue. In his journal around that time, he said, the United States government has never stood for justice one day of its life. I mean, there was that kind of scathing, over-the-top rejection of government and its doings. Again, I wonder, why isn't Thoreau, a left-wing favorite, somehow in that picture?
Well, first of all, Thoreau wouldn't have led anything then. He was a very private person. You know, he didn't pay taxes,
right,
spent a night in jail. I mean, you know, back in 1965, I, with an artist friend in Boston, I started organizing national tax resistance, which was reached plenty of people and went on for quite a few years. I mean, we didn't talk about it much, didn't consider it a great event because, and of course, there's a risk and so on. People did go to jail, had their possessions taken away. But this is far beyond anything that happened in the Transcendentalist period. I mean, it's good that Thoreau did a few symbolic things, you know, respect them, but to compare it with, say, what happens now routinely just doesn't make any sense. There's much more opposition organized in public. It's just not talked about. I mean, and the resistance in the 60s went way beyond not paying taxes. I mean, there was extensive support for resistance to the to serving in the military, which is a pretty serious offense. Plenty of people went to jail. Young people, many of them had to, you know, were jailed, others exiled. It's not a small thing when you're 18 years old to say, well, I'm going to leave my country and never come back, you know. But plenty of people did it. I mean, I don't want to make it personal, but I mean, I was up for a long prison sentence, just missed it because of the Tet Offensive. We regarded it as serious enough so that my wife went back to school after 17 years to get a degree because we had three kids to support. I mean, you know, nobody paraded about this. It was just routine. That's what you did because it was part of a substantial movement. I would have been in prison if it hadn't been for the Tet Offensive, which convinced the American business community that the war just wasn't worth it. And they essentially pretty much sent Johnson his marching orders and told him to cut things off, not to run, stop the bombing, and called off the trials, let's make peace. You know, these are things that were kind of, I mean, they've happened in American history, but they were at a much greater scale than before. And I think the mood has remained. It didn't manifest itself in the case of, say, the Iraq invasion, because the invasion itself, awful as it was, practically destroyed Iraq, never even began to come close to what happened, what we did to Indochina. What we did to Indochina is pretty astonishing. And it's remarkable how it's suppressed to this day. I mean, take Cambodia. That's the latter part of the war, long after South Vietnam was practically wiped out. In 1970, I guess it was, Nixon, then president, told his sycophant, Henry Kissinger, that he wanted large-scale bombing of Cambodia. So Kissinger obediently sent the message to, I think it was General Haig at the time, to the military with classic words. He said, massive bombing campaign of Cambodia, anything that flies against anything that moves. I don't think there's a comparable call for genocide anywhere in the archival record. At least I haven't seen one. And it was implemented. But a lot of this remains in the sort of semi-understood consciousness of plenty of people. So in the case of the Iraq War, for example, it's probably the first time in the history of imperialism, actually the first time I can only time I can think of, when there was massive popular opposition to the war, very overt. I mean, my students here, for example, insisted on calling off class and joining a big demonstration in Boston. This is before the war started. Before the war officially began, there was massive protest.
Right.
And I presume that's one of the reasons why, awful as it was somewhat constrained, certainly as compared with Indochina. Well, these are signs of anti-imperialism. They're not being, you know, you're perfectly right that they're not kind of organized, but we shouldn't romanticize you know, Thoreau and Mark Twain. They were important. It's good that they did what they did, but nothing like the scale that we take for granted now.
Noam Chomsky, what are you saying overall about the differences between the 60s and the new century in terms of imperial abuse, organization against it, resistance, and most particularly clarification, publication, awareness of what's going on?
There were a couple of years in the 60s, late 60s, say 68 to maybe 71, when there was very substantial activism. You could see it all over, you know, a million people in Washington and so on. It's a short period. And it was over atrocities and crimes that really were horrendous, far beyond those today. Today's are bad enough. And as I said, I think that's part of the reason for the limits that are imposed on imperial violence in later years. And that rise in activism was very frightening to elite opinion. It led to an immediate backlash. Take a look at what's going on in the early 70s among elites across the spectrum. So that's when you get a very sharp rise in lobbying. That's when you get the foundations, the American Enterprise Institute and others, Heritage, trying to control, to drive the framework of discourse far to the right in liberal circles, liberal internationalist circles. You get things like something that really should be read, the book The Crisis of Democracy from the Trilateral Commission. They were very concerned about the rise in democracy in the 60s. In their words, it led to an excess of democracy. We have to have more moderation in democracy. People have to be returned to their apathy and passivity and obedience. Otherwise, we can't go on, you know. And they were concerned about what are called the special interests. The special interests mean workers, women, the young, the old, students, you know, and so on, farmers. They're the special interests, meaning the population. They have to go back to apathy and passivity. There's one group that they didn't mention, the corporate sector. And that makes sense because they're the national interest. So, yes, they have to be, their ability to control what happens has to be preserved. They didn't say that. But one more phrase in the trilateral report is worth remembering. This is 1974. They were concerned about the what they called the institutions responsible for the indoctrination of the young. That's their phrase. The institutions responsible for the indoctrination of the young are not doing their job.
These are colleges and universities?
Schools, colleges, churches. They're supposed to indoctrinate the young, and they're not doing it. Young people are thinking too much. You know, they're independent. They're going off on their own. Got to do something about that. And it happened. That's the point when, for example, tuition started rising. Tuitions didn't start rising for economic reasons. I think that's easy to show. It's a disciplinary technique. You come out of college with a big debt, and you're pretty much controlled. You may have wanted to become, say, a public interest lawyer, but you're going to have to go to a corporate law firm to pay off your debts, and after that you're pretty much trapped into the culture and so on. But these, we're living in the midst of this massive effort at repressing democratic forces, popular forces, and one is the labor movement. However, it really took off under Reagan. I mean, the imagery that's been constructed about Reagan is an astonishing propaganda achievement. It has almost no basis in reality. In fact, that imagery itself is kind of interesting. If you go to the right-wing institution, say the Hoover Institution, he's described as in one of their publications as a colossal figure who's hovering over us like a warm and friendly ghost. You know? I mean, that comes straight out of North Korea. But and there is a kind of a creation of a Reagan fantasy, which has been pretty successful as a propaganda achievement. Kim Il-sung would be proud to be imitated. But the actual Reagan bitterly hated working people. He was dedicated to destroying the labor movement. In fact, he pretty much informed the business community that they were not going to apply the laws. And the firing of union organizers is illegal firing. rapidly escalated, if I remember correctly. According to Business Week, it tripled under the Reagan years. And that continued in the Clinton years. Clinton did it in a different way. It was called NAFTA. The number of corporate efforts to break strikes illegally went up by, I think, about 50%. So if there's an effort to organize a plant somewhere, the managers could put up signs saying Mexico transfer operation or something. It's illegal. But if you have a criminal government, you can act illegally. So that increased, and it was another attack on labor, as anticipated, and it continues until today. The changes in the economy since the 70s also contribute to this. First of all, there's an enormous growth of the power of financial institutions. They were a pretty small part of the economy in the early 70s, and now they dominate the economy. And connected with that is a conscious deindustrialization of the domestic economy.
Sure.
That is shifting production abroad, to Mexico, to China, and so on. There's much more. I mean, we have a partially market economy, but only very partially. But there's one component of the economy which does pretty much approximate market conditions. That's the financial sector. And that's why it repeatedly crashes and has to be bailed out by the taxpayer. Worse every time it happens. I mean, Reagan left office with the biggest financial crash since the Depression, savings and loan. Then Clinton left with another big crash, the tech bubble. And, of course, this one is the worst since the Depression. Well, there's good reasons for that. That a lot of this just traces to well-known inefficiencies in market systems. It's a pretty simple matter. Every student who takes a first-year economic course kind of learns about it in some way. In a transaction, you don't consider, in a market system, you don't take account of what are called externalities. So if Goldman Sachs makes some kind of transaction, they don't factor in the cost of bringing down the whole system. But that can happen, as we've just seen once again. And so it's almost a guarantee of repeated crises. And there's plenty of other factors. That's a core one. And, economists recognize it, but nothing's being done to change it. And, of course, in a sense, that's not even irrational, because they know that they're going to be bailed out by the taxpayer. So it's fine. You know, they can take the risk, make a lot of profit. If the system crashes, you go to the friendly taxpayer and he bails you out. And there's a much more serious example of this, which is also inherent in market systems, and it's coming, it's a steamroller, coming, a locomotive coming right at us now. Take concerns about the environment. That's really threatening. I mean, there's an environmental catastrophe coming. There's very little doubt about that. But suppose you're an executive of a petroleum firm, or suppose you're in the American Chamber of Commerce, the big business lobby. They're not a secret about it. They're propagandizing, and they say so, to convince people not to take it seriously. In the current Republican Party, the one that will be dominant in a couple of weeks, it's almost, it's close to 100% denialists say, well, it's just a liberal hoax, we can forget about it. Well, from the point of view of the executives, if you ask them, they know about the environmental risk just as you and I do, and they know how serious it is. But they are operating within a market system in which if you want to keep your position, you have to be concerned with short-term gain, short-term profit, short-term market share. You cannot pay attention to externalities. In this case, the externality happens to be the fate of the species, and nobody's going to come and bail you out. You're not going to go to the taxpayer to bail you out when that crashes. I mean, I'm a little exaggerating, but not much. These are kind of inherent properties of the systems in which the financial institutions and, to some extent, others operate. It can be overcome by government regulation. So the New Deal regulations, though, you know, they weren't overwhelming, but they were sufficient to prevent any financial crises until the 1980s. By then, they were beginning to be dismantled under a sort of a religious commitment to efficient market hypotheses, which never had any basis and have crashed over and over, totally collapsed in the last couple of years, and are being reconstituted because they're beneficial to the powerful. I mean, these are all critical factors of the current social, economic, and political system. And in the case of the environmental catastrophe, it could be pretty lethal, even for the species.
You mentioned the IT revolution, and it makes me want to bring you back to the whole Socrates role. One of the joys of the IT revolution is that anybody can look at YouTube now and see Noam Chomsky over the years, amazingly consistent, always calm, careful with facts, sometimes prescient, fearless, surely by now the best known American thinker in the world, and still a dangerous name to drop or to quote in American conversation. How do you live with this, and how do you explain it, among other things? I've seen you debating Buckley. I remember hosting a debate with you and John Sybil one time. I puzzle how you do it. I puzzle that you haven't been elected to something yet. I puzzle that you're not out leading a mass movement.
I'm not the kind of person who could lead a mass movement. You have to have the kinds of talents that I'm glad I don't have. I'd like to be a charismatic orator or something like that. And if I had that talent, I'd try to hide it. I don't like it. In fact, I don't even like the oratory of people who I admire, like, say, Martin Luther King. And there's something very deceptive about all of it, in my opinion, so I don't like it. Furthermore, nobody would ever elect me to anything if they were in their right minds, because I'd screw it up. So take, say, my department here at MIT. We've been for 55 years. We're supposed to have a circulating chair in the department. Well, it does go around the faculty, but with one omission, I've never been picked because everybody knows what would happen. It's just running a department, which is not like running a country. But, you know, I don't want the position. I shouldn't have it, and it's not what I can do. But you're right about the reaction. I'm a kind of a symbol of something extremely dangerous. On the right, it's kind of comical sometimes. So, for example, David Brooks had one of his op-eds. He was condemning what he calls, I wish I could remember the words, the conspiracy theorists who think that the corporations influence foreign policy. I'm the main conspiracy theorist. He identifies me as this. I mean, I was pretty much repeating what Adam Smith said. You know, Adam Smith pointed out what amounts to a truism, that in England, in his day, the people who pretty much owned the country, the merchants and manufacturers, fixed policy and assured that their own interests would be well served, no matter how grievous the impact on the people of England and, of course, people elsewhere. That radical truism is now considered, you know, some outrageous conspiracy theory that could only be held by maniacs, you know.
We were talking with John Mearsheimer the other day. I have over my desk an ad that he wrote, op-ed in the New York Times, in which 33 scholars, some here at MIT, said in September 2002, war with Iraq is not in the U.S. national interest. And I said, did you ask Noam Chomsky? He said, oh, no, that would have marginalized us. He also said that they'd almost got Sam Huntington, Mr. Clash of Civilizations, to sign on to the ad in a sort of realist political mode. I said, if you'd got Sam Huntington and Noam Chomsky, you might have stopped the war.
No, he was right. In fact, if he had asked me, which is inconceivable, I would have told him not to include my name, because I don't agree with it. The issue is not, was it in our national interest? I mean, suppose in 1980, some party hack in the Communist Party of the Soviet Union had asked me to sign an ad opposing the invasion of Afghanistan because it wasn't in the Russian national interest. I wouldn't have signed that either. The issue isn't whether it was in the Russian national interest. The issue is whether it was criminal aggression. Now, in the Soviet Union, you couldn't have had an ad like that. You could, incidentally, and did have critiques in Pravda saying the war isn't in the national interest, it's costing us too much, and so on. And you can have ads in the United States saying the same thing, but the moral basis for them is, in my view, disreputable in both cases. The issue is not whether it's in what's called the national interest. And incidentally, what is the national interest? I mean, that's a myth of realist international relations theory. The theory is based on the principle that states are the agents in international affairs, unlike, say, Adam Smith, who recognized that the domestic power distribution in the country is a major factor in determining it. And these states, they say, have a national interest. I mean, is the interest of the CEO of General Electric the same as that of the janitor who cleans his room? Well, on some things, like not being destroyed by nuclear weapons, but not on most things. What's called the national interest is the special interest of those with power and privilege. And if we could rise to the level of Adam Smith, we could perceive this.
Would an ad opposing a war have to say criminal aggression for you to sign it? And can't people oppose? I mean, isn't part of the game to build the broadest umbrella for saying no?
Yeah, others can sign immoral ads. I wouldn't criticize it, so I'm glad the ad came out. But I'm not going to take part in an obviously immoral act. I think what we ought to try to convince people is that, first of all, put aside the myth of national interest, we should oppose criminal aggression because it's wrong, whether the Russians do it or whether we do it. And I think that's the task of a person who wants to be serious and honest about analysis of international affairs and the positions that should be taken. Now, it's a pretty striking in the United States. U.S. debate, it's lively, but it is not very different from what you get in a totalitarian state. That ought to bother us. And if you go back to, say, Russia in the 1980s, and you look at the debate over Afghanistan, it's not all that different from the debate here over the Iraq War, over the Vietnam War. There are two sides, two extremes. One that say it's critical for us with enough force we can win. And there's another side that says, look, it's not that important. It'll cost us too much. It's harmful to our society and interests. That's exactly the same as here. So Barack Obama is considered a principled opponent of the Iraq War because he said it was a strategic blunder. Now, that's what you read in Pravda about the Afghanistan war. In fact, that's what you heard from the Nazi general staff after Stalingrad. The two-front war was a strategic blunder. Am I supposed to approve of that?
That's a fascinating question. But maybe it's what people do that is going to count more than what they were thinking or even what they said. And if the vote is no on a war, particularly in that war, it would have been welcome for me.
And to me. But there are plenty of people around who are going to say, yeah, it's going to cost us too much. My feeling is we don't have to enter that moral morass.
Right.
Others will do it. We can talk about the real issues. Do we have a right to violate international law and carry out major atrocities? That seems to be much more significant.
What is that moral and legal principle that drives you on that whole spectrum of decisions?
Well, you know, I don't think we should worship international law. It has plenty of defects, just like we shouldn't worship the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But they do express some international consensus that makes a certain degree of sense. We should at least go as far as accepting our treaty obligations. Our treaty obligations are to the UN Charter. And it's very clear on this. You can only use force under two circumstances. One, authorization by the Security Council under Chapter 7. Two, in self-defense against imminent attack. That's it. There's no other legitimacy to the use of force.
Why is media, why is public conversation, including political debate on the floors of the House and Senate, everywhere, but also in the pages of the New York Times and television, so resistant to that simple a test of what we're doing? Why is it so hard, so almost unheard of, to frame the war decision in Iraq, say, in those terms?
Well, first, we have to ask who we're talking about. Among the general population, I don't think it's that hard. In fact, there's evidence for it. So there were polls of on the Vietnam War from the mid-70s till about the year 2000, the last poll that was taken. About 70% of the population described the Vietnam War as not a mistake, but fundamentally wrong and immoral, meaning not just a mistake. Of course, it was a mistake, but not just a mistake. That's a position that was almost inexpressible.
I want to ask Noam Chomsky, the linguist, the brain scientist before we called it brain science, but the student of how the mind works, a very fundamental question that's just been on my mind. What is to make of the human processes in overdrive, it seems to me now, of euphemism, of denial, of forgetting, and of course lying, that seems essential to keep this process going, a process no matter how little people right or left seem to believe in it anymore? What's the anatomy of all this?
Well, first of all, the sciences have practically nothing to say about it.
Really?
I mean, it's hard enough to figure out how insects navigate, literally. I mean, you try to look at the neural basis for what humans do, you know, it's way beyond the capacity of the sciences. But we do know a lot about it just from intuition and experience. I mean, it's hard to say, you know, I did something really rotten. I suppose you're a 5-year-old kid, like when I was a 7-year-old kid, let's say. I had a younger brother, 5 years younger than me. I'm sure there were incidents, I probably remember them, when my mother wasn't looking and I took away a toy he was playing with and he started screaming and my mother came in and wanted to know what happened. And I said, well, he gave it to me, he didn't want it anyway. And you know, you're not going to say, yeah, I'm bigger than he is and I wanted it, so I took it away from him. You make up a story, which in fact you believe. I've seen it with my own grandchildren and others. You make up a story that you talk yourself into, you believe it, and what you're doing is right and just. Well, that's children. It goes on through life, and all of us know it. I mean, if we are at all honest about ourselves, we can find plenty of such things. Well, when it gets to the level of national policy, people would like to think that our leaders are committed to doing good. And maybe they make blundering efforts, but they're committed to doing good. They act from compassion and righteousness, maybe an excess of righteousness, as is often said in the media. But that's got to be true. Look, after all, we're good people. They're our representatives. My friends are good people. So how can we be doing horrible things? So you got to make up some kind of story which makes what you're doing right and just. That's where the doctrinal system comes in. It provides these stories for you. Now, the people who are writing the propaganda may perfectly well believe it. I mean, when Hitler said, when he invaded Poland, he said, we have to defend ourselves from the wild terror of the Poles. Maybe he believed it. You know, it's very easy to construct a story which justifies what you're doing for some reason you don't want to concede even to yourself. That's a very simple human cognitive construction. We're all perfectly familiar with it. And when it's on a mass scale, you're reinforced by the fact that others think the same thing. So everybody's doing it. Therefore, it has to be right. You know, these are the ways that populations can be driven into huge atrocities. Let me take, say, Hitler again. The Germans in the 1920s were the peak of Western civilization. I mean, in the sciences, in the arts, literature, Germany was regarded as a model of democracy. 10 years later, it was the depths of human barbarism. By 1939, rough estimates are that probably 90% of Germans were marching with the brown shirts. These are the same people who were the peak of Western civilization 10 years earlier, what historians call a descent into barbarism. Almost inexplicable, but it happened. And we're familiar with it. We haven't gotten to that depth, but the processes are similar. The brain sciences have nothing to say about this, but our experience, intuition, historical record has a lot to say about it.
I'd love to hear the Chomsky review of the strain, real and imagined, that the big American institutions are under in this season, including our own belief in our democracy, not to mention our military and our media and our economic institutions. I mean, what's the Chomsky take at this moment, halfway through Obama won, should we say?
Well, first of all, it's worth mentioning that the general population has very little faith in institutions. If you look at polls, it's almost every one of them that you mentioned, it's abysmal, maybe not the military. But, you know, a large part of the population wants the whole of Congress to be thrown out. Their attitudes towards Congress are, you know, practically single-digit support. Obama is hated by a large part of the population. Actually, I saw a poll a couple of days ago, I think it was among Republicans, asking them who the most hated people in the world are. Jimmy Carter was first. Obama was second. Well, I was happy to see that I only made 13th in a tie with several other people like Jane Fonda and a couple others. But
I'm thinking of the balance of hopes and prospects in the title of your new book, which I've read with great fascination. What are you, Noam Chomsky, most concerned about, and which problems are you most eager to sort of dismiss?
Well, there are plenty of problems in the world. But there are two of overwhelming significance because they literally reach to fate of the species. One of them is nuclear war. The other is environmental catastrophe. They're both very serious, and the problems are growing in both cases. The problem of nuclear war is, in fact, increasing. There's a lot to say about this. The problem of environmental catastrophe we shouldn't even discuss. It's obvious that it's increasing. And furthermore, virtually nothing is being done about them. The nuclear danger has always been there since 1945. I mean, there are three countries now which have not signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty and are developing nuclear weapons, advanced nuclear weapons: Israel, India, and Pakistan. All of them are developing their nuclear weapons with U.S. support. Pakistan is one of Reagan's gifts to the world. He pretended in the, or his advisors at least, pretended in the 80s that they didn't know that Pakistan was developing nuclear weapons. Of course they were. They knew it. They were supporting Zia-ul Huq, who's the worst of the dictators that Pakistan has had, a radical Islamist who was Islamizing the country, creating these madrasas, which we now complain about, with Saudi money supported by Reagan. That's one of his many legacies. In the case of Israel, well, pretty obvious. In the case of India, the United States did not support the nuclear program until about 2 or 3 years ago, when there was a treaty signed by Bush, but with congressional support, to provide nuclear assistance in development of nuclear energy to India in violation of what had been U.S. law, not to provide it because they'd carried out nuclear tests and had not joined the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So that was broken. And, of course, everyone knows that you provide nuclear technology for civilian use, it just frees research and development for nuclear weapons. So that was a gift to India's nuclear weapons program. And it shows up about a year ago, I guess it was, but yeah, September 2009, I think. The Security Council passed a resolution, among other things, calling on all states to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The U.S. signed it, but Obama immediately informed India and Israel that it wouldn't apply to them. Pakistan, you don't have to talk about. I mean, if India develops nuclear weapons, they will too. In fact, right after the U.S. agreement with India, they made a similar agreement with China, not surprisingly. India responded to the Security Council resolution, or at least at the same time, they announced that their nuclear weapons program was so advanced that they could produce weapons with the same yield as the superpowers. And That was when Obama told them, don't worry about the resolution, doesn't apply to you. So we're helping the major nuclear threats develop their nuclear weapons. Now, there is a potential threat in the Middle East. There's concern about whether Iran might be developing nuclear weapons. If you look at the reports of the Pentagon and U.S. intelligence up to the present, I'm quoting April of this year, the submissions to Congress, they say if Iran is developing nuclear weapons, it would be part of their deterrent strategy. They go on to say that Iran has practically no capacity to deploy force. It has low military budget. So if it's a threat, it's for some other reason. Well, there's a way to deal with that, namely to institute a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East. Now, there's overwhelming international support for that. Mm. In fact, support is so strong that at the latest nuclear review, Obama had to go along with it. But he added a qualification. We agreed that we should start moving to a nuclear weapons-free zone, but only when we have a comprehensive peace settlement in the Middle East, meaning a settlement of the Israel-Arab problem. That's Israel's position, and Obama repeated it. And, of course, Obama can continue, as he is now doing, to put off that settlement indefinitely. So no nuclear weapons-free zone.
But aren't we really in a race with ourselves and our own intuition, and the military shares it at some level, that these weapons are completely unusable and will be eliminated? Give Ronald Reagan credit for that one. It's a seeing through the nuclear age. Andrew Bacevich writes about it, and the military logic for being rid of these accursed things forever. I mean, isn't this some sort of neurotic confrontation with our own fears?
Not quite. Look at our own policies. So, for example, during the Clinton years, more dovish years, there's a very important document which is public, but it's never discussed. It's called Essentials of Post-Cold War Deterrence. It was put out by STRATCOM, you know, Strategic Command, which is in charge of nuclear weapons policy. What it says is nuclear weapons have to be the core of our strategic policy because they cast a shadow over every confrontation. They, even if we don't use them, they provide means for much freer use of conventional forces, and they intimidate people. And furthermore, they say we must maintain a posture of irrationality. Our national persona must be of a country that's out of control, because then people will be afraid of us. And if we have nuclear weapons, they'll be multiply afraid of us. And then we can control the world. That's Clinton. So it's just not true that the military isn't concerned with them. And there was just a report by five ex-NATO commanders, U.S. and other states. Interesting report. Said the same thing. We just like that one, they said we must maintain nuclear weapons as the core of our policy, and we maintain the right of first use against non-nuclear states. That must be the core of our policy, and similar reasons. That way we can intimidate people. So it's not the case that they want to eliminate them.
Noam Chomsky, you can't say you were disappointed in Obama because you never swallowed the Kool-Aid. What prospect do you see for him in the rest of this term on the big issues, the economy, and then these, what may be four unfixable fiascos, John Mearsheimer says, in Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, and the Israel-Palestine conflict?
I see very few prospects, and I never had any. I never saw any basis for them. He's a centrist Democrat. I don't think he ever pretended to be anything else. He's a new Democrat, you know, kind of Clinton-style Democrat. That's what we used to call a moderate Republican. The spectrum has shifted to the right, so that their moderate Republicans are gone. They're now new Democrats. The whole spectrum shifted. His main constituency was the financial institutions. That was the core of his funding. You can pretty well predict the president's policies, you know, quite well, in fact, by just looking at campaign funding. You know, investors coalesce to take over the state is what it amounts to. There's pretty good work on this. So in his case, what you'd expect is that he'd reward the financial institutions, which he did. They think he should have done even more, so they were angry at him, but they got a huge bailout. For the public, much less.
Is there any way to make a constructive force out of this dismay known as the Tea Party, but this, what I would take as a much broader and deeper rattling of our confidence in these so-called institutions?
Yeah, I think so. So if you go back to the 1930s, there was, which was much worse, the Depression. This is bad enough, but the Depression was worse. After several years, 4 or 5 years, there was a reaction which was highly constructive. The labor movement, which had been pretty much destroyed in the 20s, was reconstituted. You get CIO organizing, sit-down strikes, a major threat to management, tremendous popular pressure, which led to the New Deal measures. Okay, they're not utopia, but they were important. And sure, that could happen. But it's not going to happen by itself.
That's a hopeful note, and we'll let you go. Socrates, it is always an honor, a pleasure to hear from you. Professor Chomsky, thank you. We'd love
to
do it again.
And I'll try to avoid the hemlock.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. Our Brown University interns George Warner and Chantal Berman helped us get ready for it. The conversation isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.